Isaiah chapter 2, verse 6, through the rest of chapter 2, and chapter 3, and chapter 4, and possibly chapter 5. It should not be hard getting through chapters 2 and 3, and probably 4, because 4 is very short, and chapters 2 and 3 are kind of have a single flow of thought. Chapter 5 has a lot more in it, but we'll see what we can do with it. We're now in chapter 2 and verse 6, and we've just read about the one of the passages about the Messianic Age, which I have identified as being the present church age, whereas some identified as some future age. But we now turn from that subject to describe the God's case against his people. We might see that the case that he had against his people then is identical to the case he could make against his people now. Now, mind you, when we want to compare the sins of Israel with modern sins, it's not a right comparison to compare them with the sins of our society. For instance, if we read that there's injustice in Israel, we say, oh yeah, there's a lot of injustice in America too, or something like that. That's not a right comparison. Israel was the people of God. They were the church of the day. Therefore, we must compare them to the church and not to our society. The fact that there's injustice in the American government, for instance, is not relevant to the things that are written here. I mean, there was injustice in the pagan governments around Israel, too. Later, it came to be talked about in chapters 13 through 23, but at this point, when we're talking about Israel's sins, it much more directly corresponds to the situation in the church, because they were called to be God's special people, just as we are. And therefore, his grievances against them would be equally grievances against us if we do the same things they did. Now, the frightening thing when you read it is that you find the case he makes against Israel would be a legitimate case that he could make against at least some sectors of the church today, which are said to be his people also. In verses 6 through 9, he says, therefore thou hast forsaken thy people, the house of Jacob, because they be replenished from the east, and are soothsayers, like the Philistines, and they please themselves in the children of strangers. Their land also is full of silver and gold, neither is there any end of their treasures. Their land is also full of horses, neither is there any end of their chariots. Their land is also full of idols. They worship the work of their own hands, that their own fingers have made. And the mean man boweth down, and the great man humbleth himself. Therefore, forgive them not. Now this is an interesting thing. He lists four grievances that God has against them. The first of them, he says, they are replenished from the east. Now that wouldn't be easy to understand if he didn't go on to say that they're soothsayers like the Philistines. In other words, they are getting their spiritual wealth from the east and not from God. Now that speaks, of course, to us of the church in our day with the influx of Eastern thought, Hinduistic mysticism and so forth, as well as occultism. These are things that are certainly to be found in some parts of the church. Some movements within the church basically are simply incorporating Hindu thought and trying to synthesize it with Christian thought and trying to make it look like a more enlightened form of Christianity. And that is certainly at least as bad as what was happening in Israel there, where the people of Israel were, instead of looking to God for all their spiritual nourishment, they were replenishing themselves from the east. Then the next grievance he mentions in verse 7 is their opulence or their affluence. There's no end to their treasures, their gold and silver. And in the next one, it's their militarism. They've got their land is full of horses and chariots. This speaks of preparations for war. And remember that God had commanded in Deuteronomy chapter 17 that if when Israel had a king, he should not increase either his riches or his wives or his chariots and horses. That is to say, he was not to be a man of many wives or much money or much militarism. And Solomon, of course, we see was violated all of those things. But that wasn't the case in Isaiah's day. There's no reference to the wives here so much as there is a reference to the affluence. They're trusting in the east, they're trusting in their gold, they're trusting in their armies, and in their idols as well. Idolatry is the fourth one. They worship the work of their own hands. There is idolatry among some of the church today too. In fact, greed is said by Paul in Colossians and Ephesians. Greed is said to be idolatry, covetousness, which is idolatry. So these are the things that God said he had against Israel. And it's frightening to see that he has those same things against some in the church today. Now, he begins that statement in verse 6 by saying, therefore thou hast forsaken thy people. And that's kind of scary because, you know, in the church, as in Israel, it's possible for God to have forsaken a church, a congregation, or persons without them necessarily immediately knowing it. Israel believed that God was on their side many times when he had already forsaken them. Remember the time when Israel in the days of Eli was going to go out against the Philistines and they suffered defeat the first time, so they went back and they said, we'll get the Ark of the Covenant. That'll save us. You know, and so they took the Ark of the Covenant out of heaven. They were just assuming God was on their side then. But God wasn't on their side, so they were defeated again and the Ark was even captured. So it shows that many times people cannot even be aware that the Spirit of the Lord is no longer with them. Think of Samson. When Samson had his hair cut, it says he stood up when she said, the Philistines are upon you. He stood up and it says he wist not, or he knew not, that the Spirit of the Lord had departed from him. He was just accustomed to being able to do things, and he didn't even realize that God's blessing and his anointing wasn't on him anymore. There are many churches that were functioning under God's Spirit and under God's direction probably in the early days of their lives, and we're talking about some even denominations hundreds of years old, which in the early days of their founding were really anointed of God, but through various areas of compromise many times some churches have become quite cold, and I believe there are churches where the Spirit of the Lord has departed from them. They keep operating and they don't necessarily even know that God's not in it anymore. They're just operating through human energy and talent and so forth. And that's a scary situation, because therefore thou hast forsaken thy people. He says it's already happened. God had already forsaken the Israelites at this time, though they were still thinking of themselves as having God on their side. Why did he do it? Because of their Eastern religion, because of their affluence and their militarism and their idolatry. Those four things, which are all very common today in some parts of the church. Now in verses 10 through 22 of this chapter, it basically speaks of the downfall of the proud, those who are arrogant and falsely secure in their own wisdom and their own strength, probably in their money and in their military might and in their idols. They're lofty and proud, they feel secure, but it's speaking of the day of the Lord coming to wipe them out. Now it says in verse 12, for example, and we'll go back to verse 10 in a moment, but in verse 12 it says, for the day of the Lord of hosts shall be upon everyone that is proud and lofty, and upon everyone that is lifted up, and he shall be brought low. Now that statement is sort of like a topic sentence of this section, of verses 10 through 22. Verse 12, it's essentially saying the day of the Lord is coming, and in the day of the Lord, those who are proud will be brought low, and this whole section is actually amplified on that. I'd like to say a word about the day of the Lord, because the expression the day of the Lord is used frequently in the Bible, Old and New Testament. In fact, in the book of Isaiah, there are dozens of occurrences of it. Either the expression the day of the Lord or simply that day, which is usually referring to the same day of the Lord. Now, in the New Testament, the expression the day of the Lord always seems to refer to the second coming of Christ. You just go through the New Testament with the concordance and look up the places that speak of the day of the Lord, sometimes also called the day of Christ or the day of God or the day of the Lord Jesus Christ. These are all alternate ways of speaking of the same thing, but the day of the Lord in the New Testament always speaks of the second coming of Christ, if you read that out. In the Old Testament, however, that's not the case. The day of the Lord is used a variety of ways in the Old Testament. It always speaks of a time of judgment. For example, in Obadiah, the term the day of the Lord is spoken of as the time when God would bring judgment on Edom. The day of the Lord should be upon Edom, meaning the day that he comes and judges Edom. In Ezekiel chapter 30, and also in Jeremiah chapter 46, there's reference to the day of the Lord upon Egypt, speaking of the destruction of Egypt, God bringing his judgment on them. In Isaiah 13, verse 6, the day of the Lord is on Babylon, and speaks of the judgment of Babylon. In Joel and in Zephaniah, the day of the Lord speaks of the destruction of Jerusalem by Babylon. And so these different places speak of the day of the Lord as a time of judgment upon different nations, depending on which nation is in view in the particular prophecy that uses the expression, the day of the Lord. When it comes to the New Testament, it's evident that the day of the Lord always means the end of the world, the time when God judges the whole world, which suggests that God is not judging individual nations in quite the same way as he was in the Old Testament times. He's waiting for them all to come up for judgment. like he mentioned in Matthew 25, when the Son of Man shall return and shall sit on the throne of his glory, he'll call all the nations before him and divide them like a shepherd divides sheep from goats. So apparently the sense in which the day of the Lord came on individual nations in the Old Testament is not happening quite the same today, and the only day of the Lord that any of us look forward to now is the second coming of Christ, when all the nations together will be judged. Now, this passage, even in chapter 2, there's a number of references to this day, because verse 11 speaks of the day of the Lord. That's verse 12, I'm sorry. For the day of the Lord of hosts shall be upon it. But in verses 11 and 17 and 20, there's also references to that day, which obviously is talking about the day of the Lord also. The expression that day we'll find many, many times in the book of Isaiah. And in general, we can assume it's talking about the day of the Lord. So this passage is talking about that day, the day of the Lord. But it's not talking about the second coming of Christ. Unless it is by, you know, like as a secondary application. This is talking about the day of judgment when Babylon would be sent by God to destroy Judah because of the sins that he's just named. And so we'll read the passage. It'll be a time when these haughty, arrogant people will be greatly humbled. It says, enter into the rock and hide thee in the dust, verse 10. For the fear of the Lord and for the glory of his majesty. This verse, actually, for the fear of the Lord and the glory of his majesty, becomes a refrain throughout the whole passage. It occurs three times. It occurs in verse 10 and verse 19, where we find the expression at the end of that verse, for the fear of the Lord and the glory of his majesty, when he ariseth to shake terribly the earth. And then also in verse 21 we find it at the end of that verse, for fear of the Lord and for the glory of his majesty when he ariseth to shake terribly the earth. So we have this refrain, for the fear of the Lord and the glory of his majesty, comes up three times in this short section. There's another refrain of secondary importance that comes up twice in the passage. It's in verse 11 and verse 17. At the end of verse 11 he says, and the Lord alone shall be exalted in that day. We find that coming up again in verse 17 at the end. And the Lord alone shall be exalted in that day. And then again, later in chapter 5, which speaks of a real unity of the whole passage, including chapter 5. In chapter 5, verses 15 and 16, we read, and the mean man shall be brought down, and the mighty man shall be humbled, and the eyes of the lofty shall be humbled, but the Lord of hosts shall be exalted in judgment, and God that is holy shall be sanctified in righteousness. So just as twice in chapter 2, we have reference to the lofty ones being brought down and the Lord alone being exalted in that day. So also in chapters 5, verses 15 and 16, we have the same expression. Those who are proud will be brought down and the Lord of hosts will be exalted. The point being that God will exalt himself in showing that he is more powerful than those who exalt themselves. The proud ones think themselves to be immune to anything. And yet God shows himself to be quite capable of bringing judgment upon them, greatly to their humility and humiliation, I should say. Let's read the passage. Verse 10, enter into the rock and hide thee in the dust for fear of the Lord and the glory of his majesty. The lofty looks of man shall be humbled, and the haughtiness of men shall be bowed down, and the Lord alone shall be exalted in that day. For the day of the Lord of hosts shall be upon everyone that is proud and lofty, and upon everyone that is lifted up, and he shall be brought low. And upon all the cedars of Lebanon that are high and lifted up, and upon all the oaks of Bashan, and upon all the high mountains, and upon all the high hills that are lifted up, and upon every high tower, and upon every fenced wall, and upon all the ships of Tarshish, and upon all the pleasant pictures. Now what this does in this passage is list a whole bunch of things that are eminent and well renowned, like the cedars of Lebanon were famous for being the greatest cedars around. The oaks of Bashan were similarly notable among oak trees. The high mountains and the high towers and the high hills are, of course, in you know, the highness of them indicates their prominence and their importance. The reference to the ships of Tarshish, they were considered to be the most seaworthy vessels. They were a trading fleet that Tarshish was probably over in modern-day Spain. It's not certain, but the ships of Tarshish are mentioned frequently in the scriptures, always with reference to them being particularly fine ships. So everything that's the finest, the cedars of Lebanon, the oaks of Bashan, the ships of Tarshish, the high mountains, the high hills, the high fenced walls and the towers, those things which seem to be have something to be proud about because they're well renowned, yet they will all be brought down. Everything that is exalted other than God will be brought down to an equally low level, and God himself alone will be exalted in that day. As it says again in verse 17, the loftiness of man shall be bowed down, the haughtiness of men shall be made low, and the Lord alone shall be exalted in that day. Then he says, and the idols shall he utterly abolish, and they shall go into the holes of the rocks, and into the caves of the earth for fear of the Lord and for the glory of his majesty when he ariseth to shake terror to the earth. This reference to people going into the holes of the rocks is reminiscent of some New Testament statements, notably Luke 23:30, I believe, is one of them. But there's places that speak of, and in Revelation 2, chapter 6, there's references to people calling for the rocks to hide them from the wrath of the Lamb when he comes. So what these people experienced during the judgment that came through the Babylonian invasion, people worldwide will experience when Jesus returns. They'll find themselves wanting to hide in caves and under rocks in order to escape his fury, which of course would be futile anyway. But they should go into the holes and caves and hide out to cover themselves from the wrath, from fear of the Lord and the glory of his majesty when he rises to terribly shake the earth. Now, by the way, the reference to shaking the earth, we might think that that necessarily speaks of a global judgment. But the word earth in the Hebrew is eretz. And one thing we're going to have to be aware of throughout the books of the prophets is the word eretz can be translated earth or land. And sometimes translators just kind of take their pick. Do they want to translate it earth, or do they want to translate it land? When it means when land is the right translation, it's usually speaking of the land of Israel. And he's coming to shake the land, means the land of Israel. Because in prophetic symbolism, the sea usually represents the Gentiles, and the land represents Israel. You'll find that with some consistency throughout the prophets, that the Gentiles are often symbolized as the sea. They're like the raging sea that's not stable. But Israel, because they're founded on God, is said to be like the land. And so whenever you read in the Bible about the land, it's always talking about Israel. And when it talks about the sea, if it's speaking in symbolic terms, it's talking about Gentiles. In Daniel, he saw a beast, or in Revelation, John saw a beast that came out of the land and one that came out of the sea, which must, of course, mean one out of Israel and one out of the Gentile nations. But you'll find that to be somewhat of a consistent pattern in the prophets. Now, therefore, the word eretz, which is translated earth, in verse 19, can be translated land. And it could just be speaking of God shaking up Israel, shaking up Judah. And it doesn't necessarily speak of a global thing. And certainly, it doesn't seem to me as though he's talking about the end of the world here, because he's more talking about a judgment coming on Israel because of the sins he's found in them. In verse 20, it says, in that day a man shall cast his idols of silver and his idols of gold, which they have made, each one for himself to worship, to the moles and to the bats. In other words, they'll throw them into the caves where the bats live, where the moles live, or underground. They'll bury them, or they'll throw them into caves to get rid of them. They want them out of their sight. Those idols that they trusted in, that they actually worshipped in defiance of God, now they find their idols are totally incapable of helping them in the face of the wrath of God. And so they just cast them out of their sight, either bury them underground or throw them into the caves. To go into the clefts of the rocks and to the tops of the ragged rocks for fear of the Lord and for the glory of his majesty when he ariseth to shake terror in the earth. Then he says, cease ye from man, whose breath is in his nostrils, for wherein is he to be accounted of? Cease from man simply means cease to trust in man. You're trusting in man. In Isaiah's day, the people had a tendency to trust in Egypt to try to save them out of the hands of Assyria. And in general, they would rather trust in the armies of men than in God. There's an interesting passage in Isaiah later about this. In Isaiah 31, the first three verses, it says, woe to them that go down to Egypt for help and trust in horses, or stay on horses, and trust in chariots, because they are many, and in horsemen, because they are very strong. But they look not unto the Holy One of Israel, neither do they seek the Lord. Verse 3 says, now the Egyptians are men and not God. Their horses are flesh and not spirit. When the Lord shall stretch out his hand, both he that helpeth shall fall, and he that is helped shall fall down, and they all shall fail together. In other words, woe to the man who trusts in human beings, in human resources, because when God comes against them, their human allies can't help them. And that's what Isaiah 2, verse 22 means. Cease from man. Don't put your trust in man. He's not God, he's only man. And his breath is in his nostrils, which suggests that his breath is put there by God. His breath is something that's very fragile, as it were. His breath can be taken from him any time. It says, for wherein is he to be accounted of? That is, how is man to be esteemed? Now in chapter 3 it continues talking about the judgment that's going to come on them, and this it's kind of interesting. The theme of this has to do with the leadership crisis that they will be experiencing when God brings that judgment. In verses 1 through 8, he's describing what he's going to do to remove all the leaders. They will not have any good leaders, and they'll be desperate for leadership. And then in verses 9 through 16, he describes why he's going to do that, because of what they're presently doing, the way it is now. So it's kind of like he doesn't tell it in chronological order. Verses 1 through 8 talk about what he's going to do, and verses 9 through 16 tell why he's going to do it, what things are really like right now, and that make him do what he's going to do. And then the last verses, 17 through 26, just describe the haughty, arrogant women and how he's going to humble them.
What was that one?
Verses 17 through 26. You'll see as we read it, I'll make comments. It says, for behold, the Lord of hosts, doth take away from Jerusalem and from Judah the stay and the staff, and the whole stay of bread and the whole stay of water. Now the word stay and staff, obviously they resemble each other in English. They also resemble each other in Hebrew. In fact, the first word in Hebrew is masen, and the second word is masenah. So they're almost identical words. In fact, masen is masculine, and masenah is simply the feminine of the same word. In Hebrew, many times the word was made into its feminine form by adding the letters A-H afterwards, even with the word man, ish, and woman, isha. So it is with masen and masa. Well, masen is a staff or a walking stick, something that a person leans on while he's walking, something he trusts in a little bit. You know, he puts his weight, a crutch is what's being described here. And he just gives two words for it. He gives the masculine and the feminine form. And what he's referring to symbolically is the people in leadership, the ones that people trust in. God's going to take away the leadership. And that's very clearly described even starting in verse 2 and all through the rest of the chapter. But he mentions male and female because they had male and female leadership. That was one of their problems, he says. For instance, in verse 12, he says, as for my people, children are their oppressors and women rule over them. So it's very clear that one of their problems was that they had women ruling over them. And so he's going to take away all the leaders that they trust in, both the male and the female, both the walking sticks that they lean upon, as well as taking away their bread and their water, which would be the result of their being besieged. And he goes on further to describe what he means when he's going to take away the stay and the staff. The mighty man and the man of war, the judge and the prophet and the wise and the ancient, the captain of 50 and the honorable man, the counselor, the cunning artificer, and the eloquent orator. In other words, anyone who would be considered perhaps of the intelligentsia of their society, anyone who would have leadership ability, those who are military leaders, those who are political leaders, those who had special wisdom, the counselors, the ancient, anyone who might provide some kind of semblance of wise leadership for them, God's taking them away. He's getting rid of them. This actually happened in the Babylonian captivity. When Nebuchadnezzar came, he took away all the people who were of these classes and left only the poorest of the land in Judah. And he says, and I will give children to be their princes, and babes shall rule over them. Now, this probably isn't referring to actual little children. In fact, it's the same word, youths, that is used of Solomon when he was made king. When he said, I am a youth, and I need your wisdom. He wasn't a little child. He was probably in his 20s. Also, we remember in Rehoboam, went for counsel first the old men. He didn't like their counsel, so he went to the youths. The same Hebrew word is used here, the youths. They were apparently young men who were counselors. So children is not a good translation. It's saying, I will give you youths for leaders and for princes, and babes shall rule over you, implying that you will not have any experienced men in leadership. It'll be just the young bucks who don't, you know, have any experience or any wisdom, and therefore they won't provide good leadership. Ecclesiastes 10:16 has a statement that this reminds me of. Ecclesiastes 10:16, you probably only have to turn back about 5 pages to get there. Solomon says, woe unto thee, O land, when thy king is a child, and thy princes eat in the morning. Blessed art thou, O land, when the king is the son of nobles, and thy princes eat in due season, and strength, they eat for strength, not for drunkenness. Now, he says, woe to the land that has a child for a king, but blessed is land that has a son of nobles for kings. God is saying, I'm bringing that curse, that woe on this land. They're going to have children for kings, as it were. I'm going to take away their strong leaders. And he goes on to say in verse 5, and the people shall be oppressed, every one by another, and every one by his neighbor. The child should behave himself proudly against the ancient, and the base against the honorable. Then a man shall take hold of his brother of his house of his father, saying, thou hast clothing, be thou our ruler, and let us this ruin be under thy hand. In that day he shall swear, saying, I will not be an healer, for in my house is neither bread nor clothing. Make me not a ruler of the people. So this is just to show how desperate they will be made for rulership. They'll be looking for anyone who'd be willing to do it. Now notice he's talking about a time when there's a ruin. Apparently after Nebuchadnezzar has broken the city down, it's in ruins, and the best noble people are taken out of the land. There's not really anyone left there who can provide spiritual or political leadership for the people. And they just want anyone. A man would be inclined to go to his brother, just perhaps because he'd prefer to have his brother than someone else. He'd say, well, you have clothes, don't you? As though very few people even have clothes left. And the guy says, listen, I don't have clothes. Don't make me a ruler. I won't be a healer. Speaking of the condition as sick. Remember in chapter 1 where he described the nation as being sick from head to toe. This man says, I can't heal it. No one can heal it except God. So verse 8 says, for Jerusalem is ruined and Judah is fallen because their tongue and their doings are against the Lord to provoke the eyes of his glory. Now that's what he said he's going to make happen. This hasn't really happened. He's speaking in the prophetic perfect tense as though it were happening, but he's saying this is what God's going to do. But then he's describing why. And he's going to describe the way things are now. In verses 9 through 16 he says, the show of their countenance doth witness against them. And they declare their sin as Sodom. They hide it not. Woe unto their soul, for they have rewarded evil unto themselves. It's not that anyone else has done it. They've brought it on themselves. Say ye to the righteous, that it shall be well with him, for they shall eat the fruit of their doings. Woe unto the wicked, it shall be ill with him, for the reward of his hand shall be given him. In other words, if you're righteous, you'll get a reward. If you're wicked, you'll get the right reward for that too. So in a sense, those who are wicked have rewarded themselves evil. It says in verse 9. Verse 12, as for my people, children are their oppressors, and women rule over them. O my people, they which lead thee cause thee to err, and destroy the paths of the way of thy paths. The Lord standeth up to plead, and standeth to judge the people. The Lord will enter into judgment with the ancients of his people, and the princes thereof, for ye have eaten up the vineyard, which is Israel, as we'll see in chapter 5. The spoil of the poor is in your houses. As they've taken the money from the poor and they've got it in their houses, that's the evidence against them. It's like God has got the search warrant and come and broken into their house and found all the stolen goods there. What mean ye that ye beat my people to pieces and grind the faces of the poor? Rather graphic picture of how they abuse the poor people. Saith the Lord God of hosts. Now, he's saying that this is his case against the rulers. This is why he's taken them all into captivity. Because they're not following justice. They grind the face of the poor. He's found the spoil or the stolen property of the poor in the house of the rulers. They've taken it from them by exploiting them. And so then he describes the women, because they've got women who are acting arrogantly too. It says in verse 12, you know, the women rule over them. Well, here's the proudness of the women is going to be brought down too. Verse 17, therefore the Lord will smite with a scab the crown of the head of the daughters of Zion. And the Lord will discover their secret parts. Discover means uncover or reveal. So basically he'll strip them naked for all to see what they really are. They're all proud. But the reason they're proud is they're all adorned with fine clothes and jewelry, you'll see. He gives a long list of things they're wearing. Most of them we can't identify. They have to do with various oriental pieces of clothing. Some of them have funny names like wimples and things like that. But he's basically describing their arrogance is seen in the way they dress and make themselves up and put on jewelry and all, but he's going to strip them naked and they'll show that they aren't really anything after all. They're just helpless human females who, without all of their garb, are nothing to be proud of. And he says, in that day, verse 18, the Lord will take away the bravery of their tinkling ornaments about their feet, their cauls and their round tires like the moon. Some people who are pretty shallow have thought this predicts the automobile. The chains and the bracelets and the mufflers.
these girls driving around in their stingrays, you know, it's going to take their mufflers and their wheels away.
Their T-birds,
right. The bonnets and the ornaments of the legs and the headbands and the tablets and the earrings, the rings and the nose jewels, the changeable suits of apparel and the mantles and the wimples and the crisping pins, the glasses and the fine linen and the hoods and the veils. That's all those fine pieces of clothing and ornamentation that the women are wearing. And it shall come to pass that instead of a sweet smell, there shall be a stink. And instead of a girdle, a tear. A rent means a tear. And instead of a well-set hair, baldness. And instead of a stomacher, a girding of sackcloth. Not a pretty picture. And burning instead of beauty. Thy men shall fall by the sword, and thy mighty in the war. And her gates shall lament and mourn, and she being desolate shall sit upon the ground. And the first verse of chapter 4 goes with it. And in that day seven women shall take hold of one man, saying, we will eat our own bread and wear our own apparel. Only let us be called by thy name and take away our reproach. In other words, because of the number of men that would be killed in war, mentioned in verse 25 there, thy men shall fall by the sword, many women will be left widows. And because of the reproach of being a widow, and especially if childless, they would rather be married. They'd rather share a husband with six other women and have, you know, be in a polygamous marriage than none at all. So he said, listen, he said, seven women are going to grab one man and say, we'll all be your wife. Realize that's kind of expensive to have a wife, so we'll provide our own goods. We'll provide our own food and clothing. You just let us call ourselves by your name. That is just, we don't want to have the reproach of being widows. Take away our reproach. So he's saying it's really going to get bad for these women. They're walking around with stretched forth necks, says in verse 16. Stretching their necks out with all their jewelry and ornaments and their well-set hair and their wimples and their crisping chins and their round tires like the moon and their mufflers. And he says when he brings this judgment on them, they're going to be stripped naked, they'll be bald, their pretty smells won't be there anymore, it'll be stink instead, burning instead of beauty. Their husbands will be killed by the sword, and these women, instead of being so proud with their stretched out necks, will be groveling, grabbing on to any man they can find, saying, could we marry you? Which is, of course, a real reproach for a woman to approach a man and propose to him, especially in that society. It was always, of course, the man would take the lead. So, I mean, it just shows how humiliated they'll be. They'll be so humbled that they would even stoop so low as to come and propose marriage to a man and even offer to be one of seven wives. That's not mentioning a specific, as though there would literally be seven women coming to one particular man. It's just saying that there would be a number of women for every man because of the number of men that would be killed in war, that the women would outnumber them. Now, an interesting thing here about this is that first when it's talking about how desperate the men will be for leadership, in chapter 3, verse 6, it says, then shall a man take hold of his brother to try to make him a leader. Chapter 4, verse 1 says, the women shall take hold of a man, saying, be our leader, be our husband. So it shows this expression, they'll take hold of someone. They'll be grasping for leadership. In 3:6, where it says, then a man shall take hold of his brother and say, please, be our ruler. Let this ruin be under your hand. And in chapter 4, verse 1, where the women shall take hold of a man, the same expression. They'll be grasping out, looking for someone who will be willing to take the helm and try to pull the ship safely to shore. Now the remainder of chapter 4, and it's very short, talks about the branch of the Lord. Now, there have been different interpretations of this. Some believe this refers to the remnant that would remain after the Babylonian captivity. They would be the little branch that's left of the tree. Others believe that this should be a reference to Christ. I'm inclined to see this as a messianic prophecy. And the Jews were inclined to also. The Targums were some Jewish works that were paraphrases of the scripture, sort of like the Living Bible of the Jews. The Targums were the Jewish paraphrases of the scripture, where they take the scripture and put it into the common language of the people so they could understand it. And so there are available to scholars today, not only the Jewish scriptures, but also the Targums available. Well, this passage, the Targum translates it, instead of the branch of the Lord, it says the Messiah of the Lord. This verse 2, the Targum says, at that time shall the Messiah of the Lord be for joy and glory. So you can see the Jews thought of this as a messianic passage, and there's certainly good reason to, because the expression branch is used of Jesus elsewhere. For instance, in Jeremiah 23:5, he's called a branch. And, well, let's take a look at that passage. There's actually a number of passages that the Messiah is referred to as a branch. Jeremiah 23:5 is one of them. Behold, the days. Verses 5 and 6, actually. Jeremiah 23, verses 5 and 6. Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will raise unto David a righteous branch, and a king shall reign and prosper, and shall execute judgment and justice in the earth. And it goes on to describe him, and it's clearly talking about the Messiah. So the word branch is a word that sometimes is used with the Messiah, and I believe this is one of those passages. So it's talking about, the age of the Messiah, which we live in. And we will find in verses 2, we're in chapter 4 now, in verses 2 through 6, a description of the church age. But it's not literal, again. It's using terms, this time borrowed from the Exodus. It's talking about, it's using images from the Exodus, as we'll see. Okay, I'll read the passage. In that day shall the branch of the Lord be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the earth shall be excellent and comely for them that are escaped of Israel, or the remnant, you see. And it shall come to pass that he that is left in Zion and he that remaineth in Jerusalem shall be called holy, even every one that is written among the living in Jerusalem. When the Lord shall have washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion, and shall have purged the blood of Jerusalem from the midst thereof by the spirit of judgment and by the spirit of burning. And the Lord will create upon every dwelling place of Mount Zion, and upon her assemblies, a cloud and smoke by day, and the shining of the flaming fire by night, for upon all the glory shall be a defense. And there shall be a tabernacle for a shadow in the daytime from the heat, and for a place of refuge, and for a covert from the storm and the rain. All right. He says here that the Lord's branch will be beautiful. Notice in at the end of the previous chapter, verse 24, it says God would give the women burning instead of beauty. Their beauty will be taken away. But true beauty will be seen in the Messiah when he comes. He'll be beautiful and glorious. And the fruit of the earth could refer to, of course, his people that he gathers from the earth. At any rate, it says them that are escaped of Israel. Now, if we take this to be the Israel of God, the remnant that made it through, you know, the day of Jesus and so forth, and that therefore the church, then this applies to the church, and I believe that there's some elements in it that incline us to that view. It says, it shall come to pass that those who are left in Zion that remain in Jerusalem shall be called holy, even everyone that is written among the living in Jerusalem. This reference to them being written alludes to some other passages, some of them in the Old Testament, some in the New. For instance, if we'll turn to Psalm 87, I believe this passage alludes to this psalm. Psalm 87, and verses 5 and 6. This is that city, O city, O city of God psalm. And it says in verse 5, and of Zion it shall be said, this and that man were born in her. And the highest himself shall establish her. The Lord shall count when he writeth up the people that this man was born there. Selah. Now, it's talking about Zion, and at some future time shall be, of Zion shall be said, this one and that one were born in her, born in Zion. The New English Bible renders this rather interestingly, this verse 5 of Psalm 87. Psalm 87, 5, the New English Bible says, and Zion shall be called a mother in whom men of every race are born. Now that's interesting. Zion will be called a mother in whom men of every race are born. Now what Zion could that be but the church? Men of every race. And Paul seems to allude to that in Galatians 4:26, when he speaks about the Jerusalem which is above, which is the mother of us all. Galatians 4:26. Now, I'm just saying this to say that this is talking about the church. Paul speaks of the church as the Jerusalem which is above, which is the mother of us all. Psalms speaks of Zion at a time, as the New English Bible says, in Zion should be called a mother in whom men of every race are born. That could only be true of the church, because natural Israel doesn't have men of every race in it. Therefore, when we read in verse 6 of Psalm 87, the Lord shall count when he writeth up the people that this man was born there. It's clearly talking about, again, writing up the people who are in the church. The ones who are written in Zion are the ones who are in the church. And remember, Jesus said to his disciples in Luke chapter 10, in verse 20, he said, howbeit, don't rejoice in this, that the demons are subject to you, but that you rejoice in that your names are written in heaven. Rejoice that you're written in heaven. And in the passage we read a moment ago in Ephesians, Hebrews 12:22, where it talks about how we've come to Mount Zion and so forth, and the city of the living God. It says, to the general assembly and church of the firstborn who are written in heaven. Again, a reference to the names being written there. In Revelation 20, in verse 15, it says, and all who were not found written in the book of life were cast into the lake of fire. Revelation 20:15. So there's several references in the scripture to the church in terms of having a written membership. God has the book that has the membership written, or the citizenship, we should say. And so as we're now in Isaiah 4, 3, it says, everyone that is written among the living in Jerusalem is what he's talking about here. You want all those verses again?
Galatians
4:26.
Hebrews and Revelation.
Hebrews 12:22 and 23. Revelation 20:15. Also, you might want to add Malachi 3.